So we'll continue on the theme of Sangveka, urgency, or its other constellations of meanings, the sense of being kind of horrified at the prospects of samsara, this next reading is just a short excerpt from the Majjhima 129, which is a discourse on fools and the wise, and it's preceded by a vivid description of the sufferings in the hells and in the animal realms. There's there's one great one here. There are animals that feed on dung. They smell dung from a distance and run to it thinking, "We can eat, we can eat." Just as Brahmins run to the smell of a sacrifice thinking, "We can eat, we can eat." So too these animals that feed on dung smell dung from a distance and run to it thinking, "We can eat, we can eat." And it's about a fool who formerly delighted in tastes here and did evil actions here on the dissolution of the body after death reappears in the company of animals that feed on dung. So that, there's a whole, it's actually pages of it. Then he finishes up on the section of the fools with the, suppose a man threw into the sea a yoke with one hole in it, and the east wind carried it to the west, and the west wind carried it to the east, and the north wind carried it to the south, and the south wind carried it to the north. Suppose there were a blind turtle that came up once at the end of each century. What do you think, bhikkhus? Would that blind turtle put his neck into that yoke with one hole in it? He might, venerable sir, sometime or another, at the end of a long period. Because the blind turtle would take less time to put his neck into that yoke with a single hole in it than a fool, once gone to perdition, would take to regain the human state, I say. Why is that? Because there is no practicing of the Dhamma there, no practicing of what is righteous, no doing of what is wholesome, no performance of merit. There mutual devouring prevails, and the slaughter of the weak. If some time or other, at the end of a long period, that fool comes back to the human state, it is into a low family that he is reborn, into a family of outcasts or hunters or bamboo workers or cartwrights or scavengers, one that is poor with little to eat and drink, surviving with difficulty, where he scarcely finds food and clothing, and he is ugly, unsightly, and misshapen, sickly, blind, cripple-handed, lame, or paralyzed. He gets no food, drink, clothes, vehicles, garlands, scents, and unguents, bed, lodging, and light. He misconducts himself in body, speech, and mind, and having done that on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Bhikkhus, suppose a gambler at the very first unlucky throw loses his child and his wife and all his property, and furthermore goes into bondage himself. Yet an unlucky throw such as that is negligible. It is a far more unlucky throw when a fool who misconducts himself in body, speech, and mind on the dissolution of the body after death reappears in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. This is the complete perfection of the fool's grade. In the Sanyutta Nikaya, there's a similar discourse in that, particularly about the turtle. same description. Starting off a bit different, because suppose that this great earth had become one mass of water, and a man would throw a yoke with a single hole in it. So then this blind turtle comes up every 100 years. Would it insert its neck into that yoke with a single hole? It would be by chance, venerable sir, that that blind turtle, coming to the surface once every 100 years, would insert its neck into that yoke with a single hole. So too, bhikkhus, it is by chance that one obtains the human state, by chance that a Tathagata, an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened one, arises in the world, by chance that the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata shines in the world. You have obtained that human state, bhikkhus. A Tathagata, an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened one, has arisen in the world. The Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata shines in the world. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cause of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So that there's a footnote on that. It is by chance that one obtains the human state, saying that the statement has to be taken as rhetorical rather than philosophical in intent. At the doctrinal level, all three occurrences mentioned here come about through precise causes and conditions, not by chance. So that the Buddha is driving it home too. And I think that the intent is in that again encouraging towards putting forth effort, realizing the great opportunity that one has. So it's irrelevant in this whole discussion around effort and developing effort in practice. And the next reading is from the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara 3:38. And says the Buddha recounting his own reflections on old age, sickness, and death as a bodhisattva. I was delicately brought up, O monks, highly delicate. Exceedingly delicate was my upbringing. At my father's house, lotus ponds were made. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed, in another, white lotuses, and in a third, red lotuses, just for my enjoyment. I used only sandal unguent from Benares, and my headdress, my jacket, my undergarment, and my tunic were made of Benares muslin. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me, lest cold and heat, dust, chaff, or dew should trouble me. I had three palaces, one for the summer, one for the winter, and one for the rainy season. In the palace for the rainy season, during the 4 months of the rains, I was waited upon by female musicians only, and I did not come down from the palace during these months. While in other people's homes, servants and slaves receive a meal of broken rice, together with sour gruel, in my father's house they were given choice rice and meat. Amid such splendor and an entirely carefree life, O monks, this thought came to me. An uninstructed worldling, though sure to become old himself and unable to escape aging, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing an old and decrepit person, being forgetful of his own situation. Now I too am sure to become old and cannot escape aging. If, when seeing an old and decrepit person, I were to feel repelled, humiliated, or disgusted, that would not be proper for one like myself. When I reflected thus, monks, all my pride and youthfulness vanished. Again I reflected. An uninstructed worldling, though sure to become ill himself and unable to escape illness, feels repelled, humiliated, or disgusted when seeing a sick person, being forgetful of his own situation. Now I too am sure to become ill and cannot escape illness. If, when seeing a sick person, I were to feel repelled, humiliated, or disgusted, that would not be proper for one like myself. When I thus reflected, monks, all my pride and health vanished. Again I reflected, an uninstructed worldling is sure to die himself and cannot escape death. Yet when seeing a dead person, he feels repelled, humiliated, or disgusted, being forgetful of his own situation. Now I too am sure to die and cannot escape death. If when seeing a dead person, I were to feel repelled, humiliated, or disgusted, that would not be proper for one like myself. When I thus reflected, monks, all my pride in life vanished. So move into, say, it's Sangveka's counterpart, Saddha, confidence, faith, and of course it's always helpful to remember that, say, one of the functions of faith, and one of the say indications of whether faith is, say, one of its purposes is for the arousing of energy, in the same way that Sangveka is for the arousing of energy. Saddha is also, should be manifesting in effort, exertion, putting forth of energy. And one sees that in the spiritual faculties, the indriyas. Saddha is the first one, virya is second, and that's sort of, it's a logical sequence in the Pala, the spiritual powers. The same thing, faith is followed immediately by effort and energy exertion. So that those are, in these readings on faith, they're also to part of the purpose of reflecting and turning the mind toward that which brings up faith. Is not just to sort of convince oneself of a doctrine or a belief. It's to give oneself the impetus to put the teachings in practice and to train so that one, say, when they start to manifest within one's own life and one's own heart. Okay. There's a brief reading from the introduction to the numerical discourses, introduction by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And this follows on because I began the reading from the sort of the cosmological notes and going through his descriptions of samsara, and then he follows on from that. It is against this background of samsaric becoming that the Four Noble Truths acquire their full significance. In the First Noble Truth, the Buddha declares that all modes of conditioned existence are ultimately suffering. Even our joys are potential springs of suffering because they are impermanent, bound up with pain, and subject to change. No form of sentient existence is immune from the scourge of contingency, from decay and death, change and dissolution. Rebirth even into the highest heavens is not a final refuge, for the devas too in their lofty dwellings must eventually pass away and may even be reborn in the plane of misery. Thus, while the Buddha commends a higher rebirth for those who are not yet mature enough for the final goal, the ultimate end towards which he points is release from the entire round of rebirths. Beyond the tumult of samsara, the rise and fall of conditioned phenomena, there is a transcendent state that is unconditioned, unconstructed, without arising, change, and dissolution. This state is Nibbana, the deathless element, Amata Dhatu, realizable here and now through the utter destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion. It is this that the Buddha extols as the highest good, and it is for the realization of this goal that he has fashioned his unique path to deliverance. This next passage is from the Anguttara as well. Anguttara 3 is Sutta number 55. And it's pointing to the immediacy of the Buddha's teachings. The Brahman Janusoni was a well-known figure in the a very respected figure in the society of that time. He was a Brahman who was a chaplain of King Pasenadi, and there are many discourses where he and the Buddha are engaged in conversation. Once the Brahman Janusoni approached the Blessed One and spoke to him thus: "It is said, Master Gotama, Nibbana is directly visible. In what way, Master Gotama, is Nibbana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise?" "When, Brahman, a person is impassioned with lust, depraved through hatred, bewildered through delusion, overwhelmed and infatuated by delusion, then he plans for his own harm, for the harm of others, for the harm of both, and he experiences in his mind suffering and grief. But when lust, hatred, and delusion have been abandoned, he neither plans for his own harm, nor for the harm of others, nor for the harm of both, and he does not experience in his mind suffering and grief. In this way, Brahman, Nibbana is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be experienced by the wise. Since he experiences the complete destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion in this way, Brahman, Nibbana is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise." Discourse from the Anguttara 4, Sutta number 45, about the kind of the nature of the goal of Nibbana as well. "On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. At an advanced hour of the night, Rohitasa, a son of the Devas, approached the Blessed One, and in resplendent beauty shed his brilliant light over the entire Jeta Grove. Having come to the Blessed One, he paid homage to him, stood at one side, and said, 'Is it possible, O Lord, that by going one can know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn? I declare, O friend, that by going it is not possible to know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn. It is wonderful, Lord, it is amazing, Lord, how well it was said by the Blessed One, that by going it is not possible to know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn. Once in a former life I was a seer named Rohitasa, Bhoja's son. Endowed with supernormal power, I could walk through the sky. Such, Lord, was my speed that in the time needed for a strong, skilled, experienced, and trained archer to shoot easily with a swift arrow across the shadow of a palm tree, in such time I could take a step as long as the distance between the eastern and the western sea. Endowed with such speed and such a stride, I wanted to reach the end of the world by walking. And with my lifespan of 100 years, except the time needed to eat and drink, to urinate and defecate, to sleep and rest, I walked for 100 years, and without reaching the world's end, I died along the way. It is wonderful, Lord, it is amazing, Lord, how well it was said by the Blessed One, that by going it is not possible to know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn. Indeed, friend, so do I declare, but I do not say that one can make an end to suffering without having reached the end of the world. And I further proclaim, friend, that it is in this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and thoughts, that there is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world. And there's ends with some verses. By walking one can never reach the end and limit of the world, yet there is no release from suffering without reaching the world's end. Hence the wise one who knows the world, the one who has lived the holy life, will reach the end of the world, knowing the world's end, at peace. He no more longs for this world, nor for any other. The next one is a discourse from the Sutta Nipata. This is from the section on the way to the beyond, and it is Kappa's question. And this is a series of questions when there was a whole group of Brahmins came to ask the Buddha, query him on his teaching. Next was a Brahmin student, Kappa. "Sir," he said, "there are people stuck midstream in the terror and the fear of the rush of the river of being, and death and decay overwhelm them. For their sake, sir, tell me where to find an island. Tell me where there is a solid ground beyond the reach of all this pain." "Kappa," said the master, "for the sake of those people stuck in the middle of the river of being, overwhelmed by death and decay, I will tell you where to find solid ground. There is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of nothingness, a place of non-possession and of non-attachment. It is the total end of death and decay, and this is why I call it Nibbana. In brackets, the extinguished, the cool. There are people who, in mindfulness, have realized this and are completely cooled here and now. They do not become slaves working for Mara, for death. They cannot fall into his power." This is where Ajahn Amar and I got the title for our book on Nibbana. So this is the island. And I wanted to read an alternate translation of this, of Ajahn Jeff's, which Dr. Saratisa sometimes is, I mean, he's a Pali scholar, teacher of Pali, and I think he felt pretty confident in his translations to try to cut to the kind of the essence what the meaning of the particular sentences or phrases or the discourse were. And Ajahn Jeff has took exception sometimes to Dr. Saratisa's translations, and he's got alternative translations which are maybe a bit more precise. Okay, Kappa's question. Kappa. For one stranded in the middle of the lake, in the flood of great danger, birth, overwhelmed with aging and death, tell me the island, dear sir, and show me the island, so this may not happen again. And the Buddha's answer. For one stranded in the middle of the lake, in the flood of great danger, birth, overwhelmed with aging and death, I will tell you the island, Kappa. Having nothing, clinging to no thing, that is the island. There is no other. That's unbinding, I tell you, or that's Nibbana, I tell you, the total ending of aging and death. Those knowing this, mindful, fully unbound in the here and now, don't serve as Mara's servants, don't come under Mara's sway. The next one is just now starting to go into the foundations for what is the refuge, because the triple gem, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and those are. I mean, they tend to be sort of formulaic in their when they're written up in the in the suttas or wherever. And just in the same way, when we do our chanting, there's those qualities of the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. That's what it clusters around. Those are all have particular meanings and association. Those are what form the basis of the qualities of the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. And in the Anguttara 3's Sutta number 75, the Buddha is talking with Ananda, saying that Ananda, those whom you have compassion for, and those who regard you as worth listening to, be they associates, close friends, kindred, or close family, these should be advised about, rooted in, and established on three matters. What three? And that's confidence, unwavering confidence in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. And of course, goes into this description of those. Following that sort of formulaic way. And then he finishes up. There may be change, Ananda, in the four great elements of earth, water, fire, and air, but there can be no change in the noble disciple who is endowed with unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. That is, it is impossible that such a person should be reborn in hell or as an animal or in the realm of hungry ghosts. that the that's usually the description of one who is a sotapanna, stream enterer, that their establishing of faith, confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, having refuge, having understood the nature of samsara and the nature of what is a refuge, then the heart turns towards entering the stream and is no longer drawn into the lower realms. This next sutta is a discourse from the Anguttaras, Anguttara 11's, sutta number 12. And this sort of fills out the formula of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then also talks about the anusaptis, things to be recollected. And in the suttas, there tends to be these six are what are normally called the anusapti, the recollections. And it's in later literature that it fills out into sort of the ten recollections. Anyway, this discourse is called, say, Discourse to Mahanama. I've heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying among the Sakyans at Kapilavastu in the Banyan Park. Now at that time many monks were at work making robes for the Blessed One, thinking, when the robes are finished, at the end of the 3 months of the rains retreat, the Blessed One will set out wandering. Mahanama the Sakyan heard that many monks were at work making robes for the Blessed One, thinking, when the robes are finished, at the end of the 3 months, the Blessed One will set out wandering. So he went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, I have heard that many monks are at work making robes for the Blessed One, thinking, when the robes are finished, at the end of the 3 months, the Blessed One will set out wandering. For those of us living by means of various dwelling places for the mind, by means of which dwelling place should we live? So he's saying, well, even with the Buddha's leaving and Buddha's setting out to you know, what is our abiding place in of the heart? Excellent, Mahanama, excellent. It is fitting for clansmen like you to approach the Tathagata and ask, for those of us living by means of various dwelling places for the mind, by means of which dwelling place should we live? One who is aroused to practice is one of conviction, not without conviction. One aroused to practice is one with persistence aroused, not lazy. One aroused to practice is one of established mindfulness, not muddled mindfulness. One aroused to practice is centered on concentration, not uncentered. One aroused to practice is discerning, not undiscerning. So those are the five spiritual powers. Conviction is what he Tanjef uses for the translation of sabdha, and virya, persistence, and the mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, discernment. Established in these five qualities, you should further develop six qualities. 1. There is the case where you recollect the Tathagata. Indeed, the Blessed One is pure and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, an expert with regard to the world, unexcelled as a trainer for those people fit to be tamed, the teacher of divine and human beings, awakened, blessed. At any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting the Tathagata, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind has head straight, based on the Tathagata. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Of one who does this Mahanama, it is said, among those who are out of tune, the disciple of the noble ones dwells in tune. Among those who are malicious, he dwells without malice. Having attained the stream of Dhamma, he develops the recollection of the Buddha. And that phrase, dwells in tune, among those who are out of tune, there's an alternative translation, which is, say, the noble disciple dwells even-minded amongst those who are in conflict. Two. Then there is the case where you recollect the Dhamma. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, to be seen here and now, timeless, inviting verification, pertinent, to be realized by the wise for themselves. At any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting the Dhamma, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight, based on the Dhamma. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Of one who does this Mahanama, it is said, among those who are out of tune, the disciple of the Noble Ones dwells in tune. Among those who are malicious, he dwells without malice. Having attained the stream of Dhamma, he develops the recollection of the Dhamma. 3. Then there is the case where you recollect the Sangha. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, who have practiced straightforwardly, who have practiced methodically, who have practiced masterfully. In other words, the four types of noble disciples, when taken as pairs, the eight when taken as individual types. They are the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of respect, the incomparable field of merit for the world. At any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting the Sangha, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight, based on the Sangha. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Of one who does this Mahanama, it is said, among those who are out of tune, the disciple of the Noble Ones dwells in tune. Among those who are malicious, he dwells without malice. Having attained the stream of Dhamma, he develops the recollection of the Sangha. 4. Then there is the case where you recollect your own virtues. They are untorn, unbroken, unspotted, unsplattered, liberating, praised by the wise, untarnished, conducive to concentration. At any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting virtue, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight, based on virtue. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Of one who does this Mahanama, it is said, among those who are out of tune, the disciple of the Noble Ones dwells in tune. Among those who are malicious, he dwells without malice. Having attained the stream of Dhamma, he develops the recollection of virtue. 5. Then there is the case where you recollect your own generosity. It is a gain for me, a great gain for me, that, among people overcome with the stain of possessiveness, I live at home, my awareness cleansed of the stain of possessiveness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in being magnanimous, responsive to requests, delighting in the distribution of gifts. At any time when the disciple of the noble ones is recollecting generosity, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. The mind heads straight, based on generosity, and when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the noble ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Of one who does this Mahanama, it is said, among those who are out of tune, the disciple of the noble ones dwells in tune. Among those who are malicious, he dwells without malice. Having attained the stream of Dhamma, he develops the recollection of generosity. 6. Then you should recollect the devas. There are the devas of the four great kings, the devas of the 33, the devas of the hours, the contented devas, the devas who delight in creation, the devas who have power over the creations of others, the devas of Brahma's retinue, the devas beyond them. Whatever conviction they were endowed with that, when falling away from this life, they re-arose there, the same sort of conviction is present in me as well. Whatever virtue they were endowed with that, when falling away from this life, they arose there, the same sort of virtue is present in me as well. Whatever learning they were endowed with that, when falling away from this life, they re-arose there, the same sort of learning is present in me as well. Whatever generosity they were endowed with that, when falling away from this life, they re-arose there, the same sort of generosity is present in me as well. Whatever discernment they were endowed with that, when falling away from this life, they re-arose there, the same sort of discernment is present in me as well. At any time when a disciple of the noble ones is recollecting the conviction, virtue, learning, generosity, and discernment found both in himself and the devas, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight based on the qualities of the devas, and when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the noble ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Of one who does this Mahanama, it is said, among those who are out of tune, the disciple of the noble ones dwells in tune. Among those who are malicious, he dwells without malice. Having attained the stream of Dhamma, he develops the recollection of the devas. And there's in that recollection of the devas the qualities that conviction, virtue, learning, generosity, and discernment. They're called Saddha, Sila, Jhaka, Sutta, Panya. And those are the what are called the Aryavaddhi, and they're the basis for noble growth. The practice, it's a constellation of Dhammas that comes up throughout the discourses and teachings that are foundation for growing in the Buddha's teaching. So we'll from the say recollections of Buddha Dhamma Sangha in a general sense, and the give some more specific reflections around the qualities of the Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha sort of on their own. This is a discourse from the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara 4, Sutta number 23, and this particular discourse occurs also besides being in the Anguttara Nikaya. The same discourse is in the Itivuttaka, which is a Itivuttaka is a collection of discourses of the Buddha that he gave at Kosambi. All of the talks in the Itivuttaka when he was visiting Kosambi, and they were collected by a female disciple, Kujuttara, who was a Sotapanna, and she was a servant of Samavati, the principal queen of King Udena, and she would go and listen to teachings and visit the monasteries, and on her return to the palace she would teach the queen and her retinue. And each discourse begins, this is what they say, Iti Uttaka is from the Pali, and how each discourse would begin. This was said by the Blessed One, said by the Arahant, so I have heard. I'm choosing the Anguttara one because it's a more recent translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and so it flows a bit better. Monks, the world is fully understood by the Tathagata. The Tathagata is released from the world. The origin of the world is fully understood by the Tathagata. The origin of the world is abandoned by the Tathagata. The cessation of the world is fully understood by the Tathagata. The cessation of the world has been realized by the Tathagata. The path to the cessation of the world is fully understood by the Tathagata. The path to the cessation of the world has been developed by the Tathagata. Monks, in the world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, in this generation with its ascetics and Brahmins, devas and humans, whatever is seen, heard, sensed and cognized, attained, searched into, pondered over by the mind, all that is fully understood by the Tathagata. That is why he is called the Tathagata. Moreover, monks, whatever the Tathagata speaks, utters and proclaims from the day of his perfect enlightenment up to the day when he utterly passes away into the Nibbana element without residue left, all that is just so and not otherwise. Therefore, he is called a Tathagata. Monks, as the Tathagata speaks, so he acts. As he acts, so he speaks. Therefore, he is called a Tathagata. Monks, in the whole world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, in this generation with its ascetics and Brahmins, devas and humans, the Tathagata is the conqueror, unconquered, one who sees at will, the wielder of power. Therefore, he is called the Tathagata. And then it ends in verse. By comprehending all the world, all in the world just as it is, from all the world he is released. In all the world he clings to nothing. He is the all-victorious sage, the liberator from all bonds. By him the highest peace was won. Nibbana, that is free of fear. A taintless enlightened one, free from all woe, with doubt destroyed, has made an end to all karma, set free in the destruction of life's props. Exalted one, he is the Buddha, the lion without compare. For the divine and human worlds, he is set rolling the supreme wheel. Therefore, devas and human beings who go for refuge to the Buddha, meet him full of reverence, the mighty one free from self-doubt. Tamed, of the tamed he is the best. Calmed, of the calm he is the first. Freed, of the free he is supreme. Crossed over, the best of those who cross. So saying, they pay him reverence, the mighty one free from self-doubt. In all the worlds of devas and humans, there is none who ever equals you. So I'll leave it there for today.